Good morning, everyone. It's delightful to be back here. It's been a while. You've added a wonderful labyrinth to this whole campus center. Really, really lovely. So it's just a privilege to be here. And I can't imagine studying the Path of the Holy Fool for 7 weeks. It must have been something. I hope not an endurance test. I hope not that. So in terms of wrapping this up, it's like I've been listening to the podcasts and all, and looking at these enormously well-written study questions that Reverend Christian has done. But I want to say a bit about some of the kind of broader concepts. First of all, how I became connected and interested in the Grail legend. And that happened sort of slowly. I think it was 2005 when I heard a storyteller, not the senator, but a storyteller, Liz Warren, tell the story of Parsifal. And that was very interesting to me and caught my imagination, and I sort of let it go. It was a very busy time, lots of labyrinth work and presenting and lots of travels. And then a book floated into my life. A friend mailed me a book called The Speech of the Grail, and that was by Linda Sussman. And that caught my attention because it was what was happening to me in terms of having your speech open up. And what that means, opening your speech and speaking metaphorically and symbolically. And that became much easier and much more flowing at that time. And so between the Warren connection and then Linda Sussman's connection, and that led to this tome, literally tome, 3 inches thick, by Emma Young. And she died during that process and finished by Marie von Franz. And she called the Grail legend an eternal fairy tale. An eternal fairy tale. I love that. Fairy tales really do live on in our minds and our hearts. And it also means that the metaphors of this all spans a large, long, long time. So if you're thinking this old Parsifal story and the Grail legend exists in a dustbin of history, you're wrong. In fact, last month, I saw this. Look at this cartoon. Look at this. Two knights going across a bridge saying, "What? We're looking for a cop? I mean, a cop?" So the legend is alive and well, for sure, for sure. This was also during the time, slowly, that I began to realize, for me, the labyrinth served as a grail. Notice I said a grail, not the grail, but a grail. And there can be many grails. Yoga could be a grail. Calligraphy, fly fishing, painting, whatever. Because what it does is, as Kristen mentioned last week, a grail gives birth. A grail provides abundance. A grail opens us up and helps us focus at the same time. Linda Sussman defines a grail as a grail meets you where you are, it gives you what you need, and it forms an invisible web of relationship between individual destiny and service to the planet. That's a grail. And for me, that's what the labyrinth was doing slowly over time, really being able to help me focus my imagination, helping me to get grounded. If you've worked in any way with trauma, a labyrinth would be also a sensory integrator, kind of using their technical term, that it really brings mind, body, and spirit together and in the present moment. That's why it meets you where you are and gives you what you need. So William Blake said, "To the imagination, the sacred is self-evident." To the imagination, the sacred is self-evident. And that is so true. It's through the imagination that we see the sacred. He also said that the imagination is evidence of the divine. Think of the divine spirit, its evidence. It helps us understand divinity. And that's also what happened to Parsifal It's very fun to hear his original story. Now, understand, Parsifal is known. He's actually the third child. And that's the archetype of the simpleton, so I identify with that. Yeah, the simpleton. You know, his mother dresses him in a Dumkin hat so he can't, you know, hopefully he'll be rejected by the King Arthur's court. But he also was pure-hearted. And you have to understand, now this is a myth, his father was a king and his mother was a queen, and he had two older brothers. And the father and the two princes, his brothers, were killed in battle. And so this traumatized mother took her one only remaining son off to the country to hide and be in isolation and be far away and never learn anything about war or knights or anything like that. But she sort of forgot that you also are not learning anything about life either. And so Parsifal, probably 16, 17, 18, whatever, handsome, very skilled hunter, but he was really a dud when it came to people. He was really a simpleton about life, for sure. And so one day, and this is his opening of his imagination, he is out in the woods hunting, enjoying that day, and then he hears this whole commotion and the horses galloping. And what's happening? And through the bush come five knights of King Arthur's court, five of them. And they're all dressed in their armor, and the horses are in armor, and then the sun is glistening off their armor. And he's literally blown away by the light and the beauty of what's happening in front of him. And that's his opening. It just took his imagination and blew it open. It's fantastic in the broadest and most original sense of that word. Fantastic. So it was Anthony de Mello who said enlightenment takes a lifetime, but seeing happens in the moment. Seeing happens in a flash. And that's what was happening to Parsifal. And that opened him up. And so immediately he knew he wanted to become a knight of King Arthur's Round Table. And he goes home and tells his mom. And his mom says, no, no, no. And tells him the whole family history. And since she can't stop him from going, she makes him an outfit, a burlap, a simpleton outfit with a pointed hat. So imagination is such an important faculty. That and intuition. And both of those are sort of the Cinderella of our senses, right? They're mistreated, they're misunderstood. Oh, it's just your imagination. Or you don't really have that hunch. Don't follow that impulse that your intuition's telling you. Don't do that. No, sit on it. You see, that is what's also such an important element of our time right now. Because if we're really going to address the present day issues that we are all feeling overwhelmed with, we need the imagination to come to the fore. And we need to begin to start helping our imaginations flourish and be nourished rather than bombarded by images that come from the outside in, because those images from the outside in drain the animated essence of our own imaginations. So that's why the Parsifal story became really deeply connected in my own mind and with the labyrinth as my grail. I want to say a little bit more about the historic background of this. The grail legend comes from early oral Celtic stories. And in the early 1200s, a Frenchman, Christian de Troyes, began to gather these stories and write them down. Now, he died before that project was complete. But around the same time, a German man, Wolfram von Eschenbach, also began to collect the stories. Now, this is how myths and this is how archetypes emerge in our minds. I'm sure they did not email each other saying, I'm dying, would you finish this project? Right? It came... came because it's arising, just like the image and the archetype of the Holy Fool. Well, two things were also happening during that time. The Roman Catholic Church was not only established, its roots were sinking deep, deep, deep in the European soil. And they were also shaping and configuring, and I will use the word, hijacking the imagination of the time. That there's a three-tiered world, here's heaven, here's earth, and here's you-know-what. Hell, right? And your task as a human being is to climb the ladder of perfection and win your way into heaven. Right? And, you know, king and peasant alike believe that. And it's not as though this is done, right? That this is a worldview. The trouble is, with the ladder of perfection, kind of came out of Jacob's dream, the ladder of perfection, if you're higher up in the labyrinth, I mean on the ladder, you can see labyrinth is on my mind, right? If you're higher up, you're usually thinking you're better than. And that this kind of false self-righteousness has been developed out of that framework. Well, the second thing that was going on at that very time is the Grail legend was very popular. It was enormously popular. It was told along the pilgrimage routes as well as the courts of France and England at the same time. You see, so what's happening here? And it's what is going on here? Well, the other thing that was happening is that this is the time between 1170 and 1230 where 23 labyrinths were going into the great cathedrals of Europe. Isn't that interesting? So here's this myth going on of the Grail legend on one hand told out in the pilgrimage sites, and then here's this church establishing and nailing into place a ladder to perfection. And so I find that very curious. It's two different metaphors, competing metaphors even, the ladder climbing higher and higher, and the journey, the path that we're all on, the way we all learn along the way is living life, walking the path, meeting one another, and seeing what emerges along the path. Joseph Campbell, who studied the Grail legend a great deal, says, and confirms this in his own way, saying, the whole Grail legend is summarized in this one paragraph. There is no fixed law, no established knowledge of God set up by priests or prophets that can stand against the revelation of a life lived with integrity in the spirit of its own brave truth. And yeah, and that's the story of Parsifal. That's the story of Parsifal. And that's why, you know, it's like, oh yeah, we can learn from him. And so he goes through failures. You folks have been studying this. He goes through failures. He goes to the Grail Castle, and oh my God, he blows it. That's all you can say. He's a failure. He's totally a failure. Why? Because the advice he had gotten along the way, one mentor, he was knighted, and then one mentor kind of says one thing. He says, stop talking about your mother so much. Now, that was helpful because his mother, an overprotection, traumatized person, Parsifal didn't know his name when he started out. Now, that's pretty basic, right? He thought his name was Dear Boy or My Beloved Son. And only later along the journey, does he learn his name. So this sense of being able to be on the journey, fail at things, all the things that go wrong and all the things that go right, he's learning because he's pure-hearted. He would be someone we would now say had beginner's mind. A beginner's mind, just open. You're not defensive. You learn. You don't have any expectations. You're supposed to be super good or superior or inferior either. Those work the same way, right? So Parsifal's journey is from self-absorption to consciousness. And I love that the unity statement is that we are conscious beings, that we invite ourselves to become conscious with each other, in front of one another, and alongside on the journey. Now, the driving force in the story, in the legend, is Parsifal's going to find the Grail, which is hidden in the Grail castle, right? That's that whole thing, we're looking for our cup, we're looking for our cup, what? You see, the Grail originally was a stone in the early Celtic stories. It kind of morphed into a jewel. Don't forget, there's many strands, many varieties of these myths that are all kind of improvisations on the theme. And then later, when it was Christianized by Robert Bourne, late in the 1200s, it solidified. It was actually also a cornucopia. And I love that image of cornucopia, bountifulness. And then it kind of changed into our imaginations as the chalice. And I like that. And it can be Christian or not. It's a vessel. It's a vessel. It's a container. And that's what the labyrinth is. This is a container. It holds. It embraces. So the journey, then, is that Parsifal has to follow the path. And the first time that he fails at it is that he's on his horse. This is how he finds the Grail Castle. He's on his horse, and he falls asleep. Oh, great. I mean, you know, hey, but that turns out to be good. The horse goes on and winds up on a path and neighs and is frightened, and Parsifal wakes up and realizes there's a cliff dropping 30 feet below, and they're up against a sheer cliff going up, and there's no path to go forward. None. No path to go forward. And so he's befuddled. He doesn't know what to do. The horse can't go back. What's happening? And then appears a fisherman, a well-dressed fisherman, in the lake below, and says, keep going. I'll meet you at the bridge, and we'll have dinner in the castle tonight. There's no castle there, but anyway. And then so you know, scared, and what do you do? And oh, my heavens. And so he just nudges his horse on, and the horse takes the next step, and another clip-clop, and the path keeps appearing beneath his feet. That is the way it works, folks. That is the way it works. And the path that appears is from the magnet that we have in our hearts, what we long for, what we yearn for. That's the way it appears. Now, this wonderful painting here, I hope you can see it, is by Diane Loeb. Yeah, Diane, give a wave. Yeah. Just to show, Kit's poem with the Holy Fool in it, she wrote that in 2016. This just emerged. So the Holy Fool, and Kristen had, for Halloween, she had one of those on, right? And the cross, you could see that as Christian cross or the crossroads or however you want to understand that. And then the big blue feet. And Diane and I were talking about this, that's the way she experiences it, that the path appears beneath your feet. So here's these two big feet. And they're going different directions, by the way. They can go both ways here. So it's really lovely. So thank you. Thank you, Diane. Really, really lovely. So isn't that the way it happens? We have to give over into our instincts and stop our thinking mind, you know, of all of this going on here. And then the castle appears. And the castle being symbolic of, you know, the invisible world, the world in between, the liminal place, the place where you meet your muse, the place where you receive images or birth images. All the imagination, you hear. You hear how much the imagination is part of this. Well, in that space, we do have a challenge. Is if you can find your liminal space, and any writer who has a blank page in front of her, or any artist who has a blank canvas in front of him, it's like, hey, okay, how do you get there? And yes, yield to your instincts, yield to your impulse, Follow what emerges on the path, and that's what Parsifal does. Now, in the invisible castle, he fails to ask the question. It all disappears, and poof, it's gone. But what's so important here is in the invisible world, we don't have language for it. We don't have words. This is why it's so hard to talk about our faith process together or divine spirit impacting our lives. It's hard because we don't have concrete words for it. But what we do have is we have metaphor. And metaphor is the alphabet of the invisible world. It gives it structure. And this is the metaphoric journey we're talking about. And the Grail Castle is the metaphor for that in-between, amazing, wonderful world where true transformation happens. That's what's so important. Marion Woodman, she was a mentor of mine, a Jungian analyst, amazing woman. She said, metaphor yokes spirit and matter together without bloodshed. Isn't that interesting? Metaphor yokes spirit and matter together without bloodshed. Let's try some easy ones. She's a peach. He's a prince. Right? Easy, right? But there's something effervescent about when those two are together. Let's try Emily Dickinson. A little heavier duty here. Narcotics cannot soothe the tooth that nibbles at the soul. Narcotics cannot soothe the tooth that nibbles at the soul. How would you say that otherwise? I don't know. And the quote attributed to Aeneas Nin, and the day came. And the day came when the remain tight in the bud was more painful than the risk it took to open. And that's what happened to Parsifal when he saw the men coming through the forest and the glistening off the armor. It set him on his journey. And so along this journey, oh, so many things happen. I mean, he accosts a woman in a blue and yellow tent because his advice from his mother is when you meet a woman, kiss her and take a ring. I mean, you know, literal thinking is really a problem, folks, right? and that's what happened, you know? And then he covets the red armor from who's called the Red Knight, and he winds up killing him with an embarrassing, humiliating, a murderous hunting weapon instead of a weapon of battle. All of this stuff, and he's learning along the way. Thank heavens, he's learning. So with his learning, finally, he fails at the castle. He finally learns his name. He has all these other experiences. He is 5 years out, distraught, depressed, angry at God, lost in a forest, and just at the end of his rope. And so, here along comes some pilgrims meeting on the path. Now, they say, well, don't you know what day it is? It's the day of, you know, mourning and sacred day, a holy day. Now, later, the Grail legend was Christianized by Robert Boron, late 1200s. And so here it is, Good Friday, and this poor Parsifal is so lonely and hungry, and they say, he asks for help, and they say, there's a hermit down the road. There's a hermit that lives in the forest. Go there. Now, Parsifal, and this often happens, check yourself on whether this is true for you, but you know, when we have a big failure, sometimes we come out of it with a vow, I will never, and you name it, right? Well, that's what Parsifal did. He failed at seeing the invisible Grail Castle. He didn't ask the question. And then, lo and behold, you know, what does he do? But he chose because he knew that the forest hermit was a place of comfort and deep listening. He stayed 15 days, and he poured out his heart on all of this about the killing of the Red Knight that he realized now was murder and accosting the woman, and all of this just poured out of him. Have you ever had a healing person like that in your life? I hope so. And if you haven't, find one. Find one. Really so important. And that's, again, what happened. Parsifal was healed from all that he went through, from all that he went through. And when he left the forest hermit, he realized at that point that he needed some kind of question, because after all, he's still on his quest, right? He's going to find the Grail in the Grail Castle. But now he knows something. Now he knows that he needs to ask a question. And this isn't a question like you'd get from a Chinese cookie, right? This is a question that is asked in the moment in your heart. So he doesn't know what it is, but he knows he needs to ask a question. Let's take a moment to look at this, because this is such a theme throughout, that his teacher, who after he was knighted, the teacher, as I mentioned, said, you know, don't talk about your mothers much. He also said, don't ask questions. Knights have answers. They don't ask questions. And so that's why he didn't allow himself to ask the question when this wounded king sits at his feet on a stretcher at this dinner. And it's like, oh, you know, that's what broke up the whole evening. It didn't happen. So asking a question is really important. It implies learning. In fact, knighthood is not chivalrous, and it's more chivalry than it is battle. One of the rules of knighthood is it's a failure to kill someone. And you might have them there, and you could kill them, and you say, and this is what Parsifal did later, he would ask, are you willing to learn? Isn't that a great question? Are you willing to learn? Are we willing to learn? And then the person says, yes, yes, and he would send them off into King Arthur's round table. So asking a question helps you begin to really open up to consciousness. And again, don't forget, this is a journey from self-absorption to consciousness. Well, questions are really important. It reminds me of the joke that... remember the Pink Panther and that character, Cristal or whatever, the detective? Well, he's checking in at a hotel, you know, and he's signing papers, and he notices a dog coming toward him, and he says to the receptionist, does your dog bite? And then the receptionist says, no. And so he reaches down and pets, and the dog bites him really ferociously, and he goes, I thought you said your dog didn't bite. And the guy says, that's not my dog. you see, it's really important to have the right question. The real question would have been, is that your dog? You see, so if we miss the mark with questions, then we really kind of miss the mark in life. The labyrinth is a great place to ask questions. The labyrinth is a great place to take a question into it. And as you quiet your mind and focus your imagination, it allows you with each step, the structure, it's structured and narrowed on purpose because it focuses you, and you follow your natural pace, and let yourself walk into that liminal world. And there you can find your answers. You can also find the question. So questions are really very important. Now, I want to weave the last three images together as a closing here, because they're key to the whole story, but they're also key to what we need to do. First of all, it goes without saying, there's a wounded leader. There's a wounded leader in the story. And even though there's many, many streams of myths coming together, this myth always says it's a battle wound and it's a wound to the groin. And the wounded leader is in such pain that he can't rule. He can't, the wasteland is being created because he's inactive, he can't rule. And that is a symbol, I think, for toxic masculinity. There's an image here about that. Yeah, it leads to that. So look at this guy. This is, you know, as kind of a Humphrey Bogart. Maybe it is even him. You know, and there he is. And notice the dark, steaming background. And he has his gun hidden in his chest there. So the masculine, I think the story brings in the question about the masculine, the wounded leader, and patriarchy, and how we are, how we have become where we are is a great deal because of the wounded masculine. And I look out here and online as well, all the tender-hearted, loving men that are here and present. Thank you so much, because you see this. Yeah, yeah. You see what's happening here. And with that, then, is the second metaphor of the wasteland. And with the wasteland here, I actually chose not to show you many images of this. We see enough of it, right? So the wasteland is the image in the story. In the book, I translate that into Gotham City. Gotham City, right? You all know what I mean, right? How come we all know what we mean? You know, because I think we're in danger of having our imagination hijacked into this is where we're headed. This is where we're going. Violence, you know, and bombs and broken bridges, and you see it. And we need to become conscious of when our imaginations are taking that in. Because there's a mechanism in our imaginations that are reflective mirrors. So if we see it enough, we're going to reflect it back out into our reality. It becomes a feedback system. And I think we're in danger of that. So the wasteland and certainly the toxic masculinity, where are we heading? Where do we need to go? What's happening that we can bring in the positive? Counteracting Gotham City, and that's Earthrise. And so I know you've seen this before. There's several photos of it, and I know Kristen has showed it before. But this is taken from Apollo 8, right, on Christmas Eve, 1968. And you know that the captain of that crew did not want, I think his name was Andrus, carrying a camera on the trip? Isn't that fascinating? And he just at the last moment, follow your impulses, he grabbed the camera. And here they're all going to go out and study the moon. They never thought about studying and looking back at the Earth. And then when they saw this, you see. This is Earthrise. And we need to have that phrase, Earthrise, be as common and even more well-known than Gotham City. And here it is, Earthrise. And so to the next slide, then, because this is so important. Human behavior is not changed through moral imperative, but through a transformed imagination. And that's our task, to transform our imaginations. Wonderful quote from Paul Ricoeur, theologian. Human behavior, think about that. Someone tells you what to do. You should brush your teeth every night. Okay. I guess we sort of learn that by habit eventually, hopefully. But how do, you know, you can't just tell someone to do something. We all know that. We have to see something different. And Earthrise is what we can aim toward. Let me show the next slide. This is from a wonderful artist named Josephine Walls, and she's from the UK. And just absorb this. It's like the Rainbow Woman pushing back on Gotham City, pushing back on the wasteland. And behind her is the green land and the water and the people and the animals, you see. Let's go to the next one. This is another one of hers. Isn't this wonderful work? Visionary work. Like the tree of life, this huge tree, and the tree has all sorts of animals and people moving and being in it, and the tree is holding the planet Earth. These are the images we need. And when you're walking a labyrinth in a starlit night, or when you're walking a labyrinth with other people and you get it, and each time you walk a labyrinth, it's different, even if it's the same labyrinth, you get a new image. You get a sense of, okay, we're all in this together. And that's Earthrise. We're not enemies. We're not fighting each other. We're not pushing against each other, for sure. Now, I want to clarify, because this is one of the questions I get, what's the difference between the holy fool and the hero? And that's key. Now, in all fairness to Joseph Campbell, he was, during the war, studying heroism. And at the end, that's when he wrote his study into a book called A Hero with a Thousand Faces. Very influential book, very much so. And the Joseph Campbell Foundation has tried to soften a bit about the hero in the world. And folks, we need heroes. We have heroes among us who are vets and our first responders. This is not something that's an either or. The trouble is not all of us are heroes. And the holy fool is emerging to offer other archetypes for us as well. So, but the hero reduced basically to the original myth is that the hero parts and leaves his community, goes off and slays the dragon, and then comes home victorious. Here in this print, you can see is a Japanese print of the hero slaying the dragon. Well, again, relating to Marion Woodman's work, she points towards something that is so unconscious in us, especially if we're unconscious people. She's saying that slaying the dragon gives us unconscious, maybe conscious too, permission to kill matter. To kill matter. To kill it off. We're in our sixth extinction, great extinction on this planet. We're losing phenomenal numbers of species every day. We are allowed to kill matter. If we buy in to, okay, this is what we're supposed to do. This is toxic masculinity, folks. This is not heroism. Those two have gotten confused, for sure. So if with unconscious permission to kill the dragon, where did the dragon go? Well, the dragon is in a cave sitting on a treasure. Yeah, there's a real treasure there, but she's in a cave. She ain't going to get out. She's not going to get out because there's a bargain between patriarchy and the dragon, a bargain between toxic masculinity and this. And that is that you stay in the cave, but we'll exalt you. Mother Church, Alma Mater, all of that, you see. But the bargain is she's in the cave. This is why I loved Kit's poem about, you know, let's look at real niceness. Let's look at our politeness. Let's have the courage to be truly ourselves. And what does it mean to bring someone and bring ourselves out of the cave? This has hurt both men and women, folks. It's because it's the entrapped feminine and also the toxic masculine reigns. And that's the bargain. And the holy fool knows it. And the holy fool breaks the bargain. The holy fool breaks the bargain. So remember the lovely book, Reiki wrote, Letters to a Young Poet. Remember, there's that wonderful quote in there, be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart and learn to love the questions themselves. Do not now seek answers that cannot be given you. The point is to live the questions and perhaps some distant day, you will live into the answer. Well, that's a wonderful quote. I love that. It also addresses that whole issue of questions. But there's one little paragraph at the very, very end of the book that is overlooked. If we're going to be holy fools, if we're going to live our own brave truth in the world, if we're going to put ourselves forward and stop being polite and nice when it's not called for to be polite and nice, often it is, sometimes appropriately, if we're going to live our own brave truth, we need to step out. But just like Parsifal's mother making the simpleton hat for Parsifal, a way of saying, here, you go ahead on your journey and look like an idiot, and you're going to come back home eventually. You see, there's a lot of resistance to stepping forward. So here's this one little paragraph. Rilke Rainey Rilke here. Rejoice in your growth, in which you naturally can take no one with you, and be kind to those who remain behind. And be sure and calm before them, and do not torment them with your doubts, and do not frighten them with your confidence or joy. Holy fools, step forward. Now's the time. Thank you.